Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to Poland Is Not Yet Lost, episode 36. Last time, in episode 35, we examined the British element in the early phases of the War of the Austrian Succession. We saw how the political evolution of the British establishment affected its attitude towards the continent and the war. We were introduced to the three major players in British politics at the time: Lord Carteret, the Secretary of State, Newcastle, his rival in the Foreign Office, and Henry Pelham, Newcastle's younger brother and soon to be the Prime Minister. This background in Britain was necessary because, as we saw, it was Lord Carteret that pushed for a firm interventionist policy in Europe to broker a peace between Austria and Prussia, which would enable the former to focus its attentions on the French. This peace granted Prussia the Silesia they had always wanted, and Maria Theresa had been satiated by receiving the first of many desperately needed British subsidies. Thus, the so-called First Silesian War came to an end. Frederick left his former allies in the lurch, Austria continued its fight back, and the British continued to debate whether or not they would actually do something concrete in the continent. In June 1742, they landed a force which cast itself as the Pragmatic Army, in honour of the Pragmatic Sanction, which all honourable nations in Europe had, of course, accepted. In this episode, we're going to watch the tide turning a little bit. We're going to see how the initially hopeless Austrian position became far rosier, and how Frederick began to regret not only his decision to leave the Austrians in peace for a while, but also his poor treatment of Saxony in the campaigning season of spring 1742. At that time, Frederick had been immensely frustrated by the Saxon apathy in the Moravian campaign. In response to this, he'd badmouthed Augustus III, who was also the King of Poland, lest we forget, all across the continent. But it was his occupation of Silesia that proved the last straw in the shaky Brandenburg-Saxon partnership. Although they'd been drawn together by mutual ambitions, Frederick's annexation of Silesia, supported by the Treaty of Breslau with Austria that was finalised in July 1742, permanently severed Saxony from any land connection to the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And this meant that Augustus III's original ambitions for uniting his two far-flung possessions would have to be redesigned. His ally Frederick had plainly been all too eager to abandon Saxon interests in favour of his own, and taking this example, Augustus III proved more willing to pursue the interests of his electorate and those of his Polish crown after the Austro-Prussian peace, rather than maintain any semblance of loyalty to the cracking anti-Habsburg League. In this episode, as we'll see, Maria Theresa, for her part, was only too happy to welcome the Saxons back. Let's get into this episode then, my lovely patrons and supporters. You're all fantastic, and I hope you're enjoying this series. It is, of course, as usual, a fascinating episode in store for you today. Fun fact, the windows are open in here, so if you hear a little bit of background noise, that's probably why. Summer in Ireland can be very bipolar, but it happens to be very warm at the moment, so as a result of that, the windows are open, and let's see how we get on. Right, without any further ado, let's get back to the episode, as I take you all to summer 1742. Frederick the Great had bowed out of the First Silesian War in summer 1742, just at the moment when affairs on the continent seemed to be moving in a different direction. It was difficult to imagine that Maria Theresa, the Empress of Austria, would find a way to reverse the disastrous situation that threatened the extinction of the Habsburg monarchy. But by making peace with Frederick, however bitter that pill had been to swallow, Austria guaranteed its own survival. Frederick was allowed to keep his stolen Silesian prize for now. The Habsburgs turned their attentions to those that now required punishment and who Austria was actually equipped to deal with. These included the troubled Bavarian and Saxon electors who'd been wrapped up in the scheme for partitioning Austria in September 1741. With Frederick's exit, the strategic situation for these states suddenly seemed desperately vulnerable. The Elector of Bavaria had actually been crowned Holy Roman Emperor, but as the crown was put in his head, we learned last episode, Habsburg forces poured into Munich. Similarly, the Saxon element of the anti-Habsburg League had been greatly wounded, first by Frederick's scornful treatment of them in the campaign of spring 1742, and then by the fact that his seizure of Silesia went against the original plan for granting Saxony the eastern portions of Austria that the Saxons desired. With Prussia holding firmly to all of Silesia, apart from a few Habsburg border forts, the point in acquiring Moravia or Upper Austria vanished, as did the likely prospects of success for the Saxons. And things were little better in France, where King Louis XV had committed French forces to the defence along the Rhine and then to a campaign in the Austrian Netherlands, rather than launch any more schemes into the centre of the empire. The latter scheme had landed the anti-Habsburg coalition the city of Prague in November 1741, but this flutter of success proved to be the high point, and the second capital of the Habsburgs was soon recaptured. As much as French power continued to be demonised by the maritime powers, and as much as Maria Theresa now contented herself with focusing upon undermining the French military position, Frederick the Great knew full well that Louis XV of France would not be in a position to stand up against so many powers. With Bavaria on the payroll and Saxony drifting away, the only opportunity for striking a decisive blow at the gathering allies would be an invasion of Hanover. But such a scheme had been barred thanks to a British landing in June 1742, perhaps it was a preemptive landing, and the collection of a large army soon appeared there. It could not be said for certain where this pragmatic army would strike next, but with a reported strength of 60,000 men, which was no small feat for the British to arrange at the time, it was critical that the French could not allow it to further upset the precarious balance of power on the continent. Far to the east, even Frederick's secure Russian front now seemed to be in flux. While the French ambassador in St. Petersburg had worked wonders, playing a role in toppling the regent regime over the late Tsarina's infant grand-nephew in 1741, and provoking a war between Russia and Sweden shortly after to keep the whole area tied up, the once fearsome Swedes performed poorly, and they seemed resigned to defeat by late 1742. This defeat would free Russia from the local conflict, and under the new Empress Elizabeth, a daughter of Peter the Great, it seemed highly likely that Russia would seek to reinvolve itself in European affairs, as it had done during the War of the Polish Succession. The scramble to acquire Russian support had been ongoing between British and French agents since the late 1730s, but the shaky Russian governments had proved difficult to pin down. While the pro-French party remained in control, it was entirely likely that the group would fall from power with enough prodding by the British, who were beginning to formalise their relationship with the Russians through several groundbreaking treaties, not to mention the official recognition of the Russian leaders as emperors and empresses, which, by the way, the British had only accepted by 1740. The historian Jeremy Black noted that Austria's principal problem in 1740-41 was the Russian failure to intimidate Prussia, as she had done in the mid-1730s, a task Britain could not have achieved. It was for this reason that real effort and real monies were invested in the securing of an Anglo-Russian treaty, which would formalise some sort of Russian policy against Prussia, which in the minds of the British meant arranging a defensive alliance that could also be directed against France, because yes, it was all connected. Since the cold Anglo-French War hadn't yet turned hot, it was believed that much could be achieved if the Russians could only be persuaded to guarantee the pragmatic sanction and apply the necessary pressure against the Prussians. However, although these aims developed during the course of the Anglo-Russian negotiations between essentially 1739-42, they were essentially far less ambitious in scope, and as we'll see, the likelihood of success was consistently hampered by the volatility of the Russian succession between 1740-42. For the next little while, though, we're going to spend a bit of time placing these relations between London and St. Petersburg in context. Anglo-Russian relations were in their infancy by the time a Russian contingent appeared along the Rhine during the War of the Polish Succession, and awakened Europe to the fact that the Russians had definitively arrived. From 1739, a concerted effort was made to reach some kind of agreement with the Russians, which would bring them securely into the pro-British camp, but there were several problems with this. One of the most glaring concerned the British agent on the ground in St. Petersburg, who had to deal with a lack of German on his own part and a lack of French on the part of the Russians. In addition to this, there was fierce disagreement in St. Petersburg over whether a commercial treaty could be agreed on or whether London should even actively seek an alliance. Any effort to bring about some kind of defensive alliance had to bring with it some important caveats. Since both powers obviously operated in such different spheres, it was essential that certain expectations to any defensive clauses were made. In the British mind, any Russian conflict with Orientals in the Far East or with the Ottomans should not involve them, but in the view of the Russians, the British attempted to stretch what Oriental actually meant too far. The British insisted that Orientals applied to the Turks, Persians, and, interestingly, the Poles, while the Russian officials in St. Petersburg argued furiously against the notion that Russia's most western neighbour could possibly be considered Oriental. It was suspected that Britain wanted to have its cake and eat it too, for the British negotiations began in late 1739 on the understanding that while Britain would not go to war with all of Russia's rivals, Russia would be expected to make war on most of Britain's. Like the Polish issue, the Russians opposed the idea of fighting the French and the Spanish. Only the secret stipulations of Austria and Prussia were put forward, in addition to Sweden in the future, if that proved necessary. The mentioning of both Austria and Prussia in these Anglo-Russian negotiations proved that Frederick had been right to worry, though he never actually saw the treaty himself. Anglo-Russian negotiations compromised by agreeing to hold the British fleet in the Baltic for a certain length of time to protect Russian security there, and for a Russian agreement to defend British interests if Hanover were attacked, although it was stipulated that a Spanish attack in the Mediterranean against Gibraltar, for example, could not be construed as an attack on the House of Hanover. Now, it may seem almost ridiculous that such things had to be specified, but in dealing with the earliest of diplomatic relations, several things often taken for granted needed to be clearly defined. Otherwise, the British could argue that an attack on one's interests and security were the same thing, and they could easily breach this treaty if they saw the need. Additional stipulations of interest to us include one which stated Russia's continued maintenance of suzerainty over the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. In fact, this was mentioned in the second of six articles which the British agreed to, thus demonstrating the fact that, by 1740, a recognised position of superiority had already been taken up over Poland by St. Petersburg. If it hadn't been clear before, Poland was definitively now the Russian backyard. In the event, while the treaty was sent back to Britain by early October 1740, we know now that everything changed thereafter, as the successive deaths of Empress Anna and then Charles VI, the Holy Roman Emperor, threw everything out the window. The British ambassador in St. Petersburg tried to meekly maintain that the treaty required only his master's signature in London, but in reality, the British wanted to see what would happen in Russia before agreeing to anything. The change in regime could mean that a very different Russia, led potentially by brand new ministers, could direct Russian policy from 1741. This, indeed, was what Frederick the Great also feared. In his article on these negotiations, where we're getting most of the information from today, Richard Lodge noted that when Frederick attacked Silesia in December 1740, Anglo-Russian diplomacy was thrown into a further quandary, as both sides tried to deal with this stunning succession of disruptive events in the West. Richard Lodge wrote, "It was clear that if the indivisibility of Austrian dominions was once sacrificed, others would insist upon a share in the spoil. Also, Prussia was inconveniently near to Russia, and the aggrandizement of Prussia was as undesirable as the weakening of Austria. The Russian Chancellor expressed his willingness to concur in any plans for the coercion of Prussia, which might be put forward by the maritime powers. But Great Britain, while demanding that Russian troops should invade East Prussia, would formulate no plan for its own action because the safety of Hanover was at stake. And so matters reached a deadlock, from which Prussia industriously profited." Just as matters seemed to be settling down and Anglo-Russian relations were resumed, In early December 1741, a coup in Russia, which placed the aforementioned Empress Elizabeth on the Russian throne, was arranged. Through this act, the so-called German party was expunged from the Russian court, and a set of new ministers were placed in charge. Edward Finch, the aforementioned British ambassador who was sent to negotiate the Russian treaty, was aghast that the coup against the old regime should have taken place, and the anger in his comments about it can be discerned as coming as much from his frustration as having his work undone by the new Tsarina, as it can be as coming from his fear that this Tsarina would discover Finch had long warned the old Russian regime that Elizabeth had been planning something. He wrote that Elizabeth's coup had succeeded much beyond their expectations, and according to all appearance, their wishes also, which was entirely owing to the stupid folly and madness of the late government, and not at all to the address and skill of those who conducted the scheme. In the end, the ambassador was so fearful that he'd be found out, Finch returned home to Britain in spring 1742, leaving the completion of his old work to a successor, whose eventual success in bringing the Anglo-Russian Treaty about changed very little in Europe. Its significance instead is found in the fact that it brought Elizabeth's regime in line with British aims. On paper at least, in the treaty, fully ratified by all parties, in March 1743, Russia was obliged to attack France if the French attacked Hanover. Thanks to the passage of time since the old ambassador Finch had drawn up the original plans, the Swedish threats were removed, and Britain would no longer have to keep its fleet in the Baltic to defend Russian interests, largely because the Tsarina Elizabeth had occasioned a change in Russian outlook by moving the court back to Moscow. This move was seen by some in Russia as the beginning of a more insular Russian policy, but while Elizabeth would no longer advocate intervention or the straightforward policy of loyalty to Austria and Prussia which her predecessors had adhered to, she also wasn't prepared to turn back the clock and ignore her neighbours. The plan was to keep Austria and Prussia at arm's length. For now, the main issue was waiting to see what would happen next. With the peace treaty signed between Austria and Prussia, and the Tsarina Elizabeth giving her acceptance of that peace treaty in writing, it seemed as though Russia was free to take up arms against the French, which of course, in the interconnected Europe of the 1740s, was bad news for France's major ally, the Prussians, even if Frederick the Great was still technically at peace with Maria Theresa. The reason why we went through this Anglo-Russian scenic route then was to demonstrate how the diplomatic tide was beginning to turn against the French, and as a result, explain why Frederick felt he had no choice but to resume the Silesian War. If affairs in Eastern diplomacy were producing worrying whispers about an Anglo-Russian alliance aimed at France and at a decline in French influence in St. Petersburg, then affairs in the West between the French, Austrians and British suggested that Paris was entering a downward spiral, which only the timely intervention of Frederick the Great could rescue it from. In the 2 years of peace which served as the interim between the two Silesian Wars, Frederick the Great sought to raise a coalition of German princes against the Habsburgs and British. This was done, Frederick argued, to secure the liberty of the Holy Roman Empire, the dignity of the Emperor, and the peace of Europe. But in reality it was done for his own interests, and would-be allies saw right through the scheme. It had also become far more difficult to rally against the Habsburgs on the continent, because in the latter half of 1742, Austria had become the recognised stronger power in Germany, and perhaps on the continent as well. It was quite a turnaround, and while Austria was dependent upon British monies, so long as these continued to flow in, it didn't matter all that much. In the British view, keeping Frederick out of the war was vital, because this would guarantee that Austria focused all their attentions on the French, and thus that would mean that the French would have no time to attack Hanover. I should add that Britain and France were not actually at war at this point, and they wouldn't make their covert war public until 1745. This explains how Britain was able to arrange a defensive alliance with Russia that had been aimed at France. One could hardly aim a defensive pact at a power that one was already at war with, after all. Perhaps the most striking development in the years between the two Silesian Wars wasn't the accelerated Austrian triumphs of Bohemia and Moravia, but the contribution given by the still technically at peace British. As we saw the last time, despite how horrified such a policy made the Duke of Newcastle and Lord Carteret, their king, George II, had made a promise of neutrality with the French in return for a French pledge not to harm Hanover. The agreement was somewhat pointless, of course, since the British were perfectly willing to continue negotiating treaties against the French with Austria and Russia. In addition, while Britain didn't declare war on the French until later on, they did grant their armed forces to the disposal of their allies on the continent. Coming to aid the so-called Pragmatic Army, 17,000 troops had been landed in June 1742, and by the following July, these men were finally on the move. This time the lines between war and peace were further blurred, as none other than King George II commanded the 50,000 strong army as it moved towards Frankfurt, where the sham Bavarian Emperor had made his base. The Battle of Dettingen was actually the result of skillful entrapment and manoeuvre on the part of the French, who had managed to cut off the Austro-Anglo-Hanoverian army from its supplies by mid-June 1743, after it had marched due east out of Hanover. Trapped and forced to withdraw right back into the town of Dettingen, where the French were waiting for them, the day was won for the Allies, thanks to the resolve of their infantry and the impatience of the French commanders. One French commander in particular abandoned his position and charged with his cavalry, which prevented the brilliantly positioned French artillery from firing and opened him up to an Allied counterattack that proved decisive. The Battle of Dettingen, which took place on the 27th of June 1743 in the extreme northwest of Bavaria, was not a crushing victory by any stretch, and the French lost roughly 5,000 to the Allied 2,000, but it was significant for other reasons. It frustrated the French, who were forced to abandon several positions in Bavaria, which made the Habsburg conquest of Bavarian lands easier, and the Allied contingent was led by a King of Britain on the battlefield for what would prove the final time. George's command of the Allied army seemed to contradict his previous policy of extreme caution when it came to dealing with continental matters. Surely, having now commanded the Allies, he would declare himself one way or the other, and fully enter the side of the Austrians? In the event, it suited the King of Britain to dally, and it suited the French not to formalise the conflict as well, since this would have entailed additional commitment from them. Already the French and Spanish had collaborated in their defence of their American possessions, and George's interference here, while it was closer to home, thus did not have to necessitate a declaration from either side. In Frederick the Great's mind, Dettingen represented the low point of French fortunes. Already he was aware that in September 1742, the Saxons had signed a peace with Austria. On the 20th of December 1743, this was developed into an alliance, which, although defensive, was plainly aimed at Frederick. This turn of fortunes, coming after his own exit from the conflict, demonstrated plainly to Frederick that he needed to weigh in on this conflict if he was going to secure his Silesian holdings, lest the victorious Austrians, aided by their vengeful and jealous Saxon ally, would turn their attention towards him once the French were defeated. With this in mind, Frederick greeted news of the British adherence to the alliance in February 1744 with unease, but not much surprise. By now it was inevitable that his peace with Austria would have to be broken, and for the sake of his national security, an attack would have to be launched against the Austro-Saxon arrangement. Frederick continued to greatly fear any news that came from Russia over Tsarina Elizabeth's stance. He suspected that any attempt to punish Saxony would be treated with hostility in Russia, since the Russians had placed Augustus III on the throne of Poland after all, and couldn't afford to have him irreversibly humbled. Frederick exercised a bit of caution, for the moment at least, but this wouldn't last. On the 5th of June 1744, Frederick formalised an offensive alliance with France, and by August, he was on the march with his brothers. Despite the worrying news from certain spheres, there was reason to be positive in Berlin. After all, Brandenburg-Prussia had been at peace for nearly 2.5 years, and it had built up its army and monies as it did so, while Austria had been expending both, and was apparently occupied along the Rhine. The Prussian plan involved a quick dash to Prague, followed by an invasion of the Austrian Habsburg lands. With Vienna under threat, it wouldn't matter what agreements Maria Theresa had made with Saxony or Britain, since their paltry land armies would hardly be able to save her then. The plan went well at first, and at the resumption of war, the capture of Prague came quickly on the 16th of September 1744. For the third time, the city had changed hands. The next phase seemed likely to yield the same results, but Frederick had made a critical error in assuming that the French would cooperate with him by holding Austrian attentions along the Rhine. Louis XV proved more interested in seizing some more tangible gains in the Austrian Netherlands rather than make any new initiatives into the thankless Holy Roman Empire, and this enabled Charles of Lorraine to march hastily back east with a force of 50,000. This formidable army was joined by an old rival, the Saxons, who contributed 20,000 of their own men to the campaign on the 21st of October. Suddenly, the once pathetic Saxons didn't look so vulnerable. Now it was Frederick the Great who would have to think on the fly. In spite of these worrying trends and the sudden appearance of several strong armies on the horizon, Frederick's greatest problem from autumn 1744 was that his enemies would not give him battle, and instead greatly reinforced the region of Bohemia with overwhelming numbers. After some consultation with his generals, Frederick determined that it was time to cut his losses, and he sounded the retreat. His once fresh army suffered terribly between October and November 1744 from disease and poorly planned supply routes, which the Allies had gleefully cut off. Not even Prague could be saved. That hot potato was abandoned to change hands for the fourth time on the 26th of November as the Prussians fled back into Silesia. Of the 17,000 men who left Prague, only 2,000 actually made it back to Silesia. A devastating loss when one considers that this represented 15% of Frederick's total force. These men could not be quickly replaced, and worse news seemed to loom as reports of mutiny even reached the king in Prussia. One count of the Prussian army reported after the disaster in autumn 1744 that "We no longer have an army. What we have is nothing more than a bunch of men held together by habit and the authority of their officers, and even these officers are discontented, many of them in a desperate condition indeed. All we need is the slightest setback, or the decision to continue the war during the winter, for there to be a mutiny." For mutiny to even receive mention in Prussia's robotically professional army was a sign of how bad things have gotten. Frederick had again demonstrated nothing but a juvenile contempt for his enemy and a galling tendency to throw away accumulated resources of men and money. These qualities didn't bode well for Frederick or for Prussia if he didn't learn his lesson. Worse news was still to come in the new year of 1745, for it opened with the death of the Bavarian Holy Roman Emperor, Charles Albert. Immediately, his son, Maximilian III, made amends with the Habsburgs and extricated himself from the conflict before matters grew worse for his once glorious duchy. On the 8th of January 1745, a quadruple alliance was signed between Britain, Austria, the Dutch and Saxony, and through the funds promised by that agreement, Saxony was able to raise its army to 30,000 men. Augustus III of Saxony and Poland, once considered so inconsequential by Frederick, now posed such a genuine threat to his realm that the French intermediaries sought to bribe the Saxons out of the alliance with the promise of the office of Holy Roman Emperor for Augustus III. Now, as greedy as Augustus demonstrably was, and as grasping as he was for titles, even he accepted that to become the Elector King Emperor was a stretch too far. Furthermore, Augustus also accepted that the French would soon no longer be in a position to offer the office, as Maria Theresa's husband sought finally to stand for that position from a position of proper strength himself, which Vienna had built up since the early dark years of the war. Augustus III was now laser-focused instead on destroying Frederick's power and reducing the once junior Protestant elector to the status of a third-rate power. In the process of this reduction, Augustus fully intended to be compensated for his efforts by the Austrians. He still wanted to unite Saxony with Poland through a land corridor, which only the Habsburgs could legally provide. This quadruple alliance was also known as the Warsaw Treaty, and it was significant for another reason, in that it represented one of the first times that Britain actually became interested in what Saxony was doing. By tying Saxony to its defence policy, you won't be too surprised to learn, British policymakers hoped to further insulate that chestnut of the 18th century, Hanoverian security. A quick glance at the map of Europe in the 1740s shows how integral Saxon friendship could be to Hanover. With it, a large chunk of territory would be in the way of both France and Prussia, but for Frederick the Great, his gradual realisation of the disaster that was Saxon hostility revolved around another point. Thanks to the Russian connection to Saxony's Elector King, and the connection of that figure to Poland, this meant that Prussian hostility to Saxony could be construed by Tsarina Elizabeth as hostility to Russian interests in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. If anything was to rouse the Russians from their relative slumber in international relations, it was the question of their suzerainty over Poland, which, as we saw earlier, had been specifically mentioned in the Anglo-Russian Defensive Alliance. Frederick's protestations that he had no intention of harming Russian interests in Poland, or of dealing with the Poles in general, would never be official enough for Frederick to not unofficially fear an invasion of his eastern domains from the Russians. Had he managed to maintain the Saxon friendship, then such an eventuality would never have taken place, since the Russians would hardly have turned against the ally of the Saxons, whose elector they had played a large role in elevating to their favourite eastern crown. Yet, Frederick had squandered these opportunities by 1745, and the developing coalitions against him were a testament to his failures as a ruler. Had his story ended there, and it seems highly likely that it could, then we history friends could well have come to know that king in Prussia as Frederick the Squanderer. That posterity has since maintained the title of the Great has as much to do with the length of Frederick's reign and his staying power within that tenure of rule as it does with what he did with the remnants of 1745. What did he do to rehabilitate his position? Well, next time, we'll see why history knows this apparently hapless king as Frederick the Great, when we bring to an end our analysis of the Second Silesian War. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode, my lovely history friends and patrons, and I hope you'll join me next time. But until then, my name is Zach, and thanks for listening. I'll be seeing you all soon.